Okay, well, we'd like to welcome everybody this evening. Good evening, and I'm your host, Melinda Gerrish. I'm the owner of Cutting Up Stables here in Shirley, Indiana, which is east of Indianapolis. We want to thank everyone for tuning in this wintry January night, and now that the holidays are over, just sit back and relax and grab something warm to drink, and Karen, let's talk horses tonight. Tonight's topics are the first one we're going to be talking about, horse that's panics in a trailer. And then we're going to go into the bumblebee camp and preparing your horse for a long haul in a trailer, a puzzling horse behavior, regaining some confidence, saddling, and relaxing a nervous horse. So we'll go ahead and I'll read the first question. This one is from Susan, and it says, I need some advice on how to keep my horse calm in my two-horse slant trailer. When I loaded my 14-year-old gelding Jake in my former two-horse straight load trailer, he never was completely comfortable, but he tolerated the ride. Jake would lean on the front and on the butt bar. Jake could only stand in one spot without a lot of room. But when I bought my two-horse slant trailer that has more room and without anything to lean on, he panics. He'll load in the trailer. I can feed and brush him in the trailer, but when I start the truck's motor, he panics. Jake has actually fell over while in the trailer. He wasn't hurt, and I did let him walk out of the trailer, but I immediately got him back in. I have tied him in the trailer, and he panics. I've tried just letting him loose in the trailer, and he panics and tries to find a way out. I've tried with and without a buddy horse. I've had friends tell me to just tie him up and start driving, but I'm worried about him injuring himself. I've had other friends tell me about some horses are just not able to be trailered because of fear or past experiences. I've had Jake 7 years now, and I was able to take him in my smaller two-horse trailer. Jake was never really comfortable in that trailer either, but he just couldn't move once the door was shut. I don't want to take any chances of getting him hurt, but is there anything else I can do? I do have a couple other horses I can trailer, so she doesn't have to depend on him. And he could just stay home, but or she's considered buying another an old two-horse trailer to fit him in. Any advice would be appreciated.
Well, it's interesting because as I listen to questions, I'm always listening for clues that might be contributing to different behaviors. One of the things that you need to think about is, how is that horse really loading into the trailer? Oftentimes when horses have problems in the trailer, even though they walk into the trailer or you can walk in with them, they're not really right about the trailer. It's not really their choice to be in the trailer. They've kind of, you know, through their life decided that getting into the trailer is the better option than not getting into the trailer. So one of the things to go back to, again, it's always going back and finding out where the hole is. Has it ever been Jake's idea to load into the trailer? For example, if the trailer doors were left open and, you know, left open in an area where he was loose, would he go over and just out of curiosity and confidence go in and mess around inside the trailer? That to me is a horse that's curious and willing and confident in a trailer, that they would go in there by themselves. I warn people when I do trailer loading sessions with them, I'll warn them. I'll go, now, watch out, because tomorrow this horse who's dragging us around all over the place today is going to push past you to go in the trailer. That's how much willingness and, you know, positive response we're going to get from the session. And people always look at me like I'm crazy, and then the next day they're going, oh my gosh, Karen, the horse did just what you said. It pushed past me because it wanted to go in the trailer. That's really where the problem usually lies. Not always, but usually. And the horse that was a good example of this was there at your place, Melinda, when we did that last clinic. The Palomino mare had been hauled all over the place. She'd been to lots of shows. But when I asked her to go into the trailer without me, to walk past me and walk into the trailer and then stand there indefinitely without coming out until I asked her to come out, boy, I'll tell you what, we had a go-around there because she'd never been asked to that level of expectation. And so what people were confused because they said, you know, she always walks in with us. Well, walking in with you is a conditioned response. You can walk a horse with you through scary things. I rode with a good friend the other day, and we had to go under this tunnel. And my horses weren't real confident with it, but I said, hey, here's an opportunity to ask my horses to follow my leadership from up on my back. She felt more comfortable leading the horse through. And the horse was fine. He didn't hesitate leading through the tunnel. So what we don't always realize is that the horse can become conditioned to leading them through places. If it's something they're familiar enough with, which means the human is standing next to me and kind of going with me or first, then the horse can kind of manage its way through it. But when you ask the horse to go past you and go into it without you leading it into it, oftentimes you'll find that the horse really isn't making the choice to get in the trailer in the first place. The other thing to do is, and that's why I would recommend, is going back to the foundation, going back to the simulations that I show on the trailer loading video that I offer, and go through those stages and make sure that that is not where your problem is. Because if that isn't remedied right there, nothing else you'll ever do will ever get right. So I'm going to tell you these other things to do once this piece is in place. And that is, once the horse is in the trailer, and I've had horses where they have done, you know, kind of describing the same thing. Once it goes into motion, the vehicle engine begins, the horse starts getting nervous and starts calling and that kind of thing. And when the engine stops, the horse is fine. So I've taken it back to where I've gone back to that foundation. Everything's good. Then when I start the engine, the horse is uncomfortable, and the horse starts shifting around, and I'll start the engine. I'll drive 15 feet and stop and turn off the engine and bring out a book or a magazine and just read my book for 10, 15 minutes. The horse goes back to just relaxing and hanging out. And I literally spent, it wasn't too long. It's probably about an hour, hour and a half with a horse, and I never left the property. I just drove back and forth across the property, and pretty soon that horse just started going, well, I'm not getting out of the trailer, and we don't seem to be going very far, and every trip I've taken today, which is about 17 trips, you know, here in an hour, have all been good. And pretty soon that horse started putting all the pieces together and started disassociating the beginning of the engine, the start of the engine, with, oh, no, here comes, you know, my rock and roll down the road. The other thing to remember is when we're turning a vehicle or when we're going down the road, we don't always realize, because we're sitting in the front, how much shift happens back there in that trailer. Now, if you tell anybody I said this, I'll deny it, but this is being recorded. A good thing to do is, and you can stay on your property to do this, is hook up your trailer, have somebody you trust implicitly driving the vehicle, and stand back in your trailer and have that person drive, even just across your property, never leaving the property, and see what it feels like to be back there, you know, like the horse is, and have people make turns. I did this in some college courses that I took, and the instructor was driving, and we got done, and she had the whole class loaded in the back of the trailer, which was fantastic. She said, don't use your hands to balance, just your feet. And it was really amazing. She said, okay, guess what my speed was, guess how fast I was going. And we were all guessing almost double what she was really driving. So it's a good way to get some sensitivity to what that horse is dealing with back there. And a horse can have one bad experience where they lose their footing or they scramble or a mat shifts, and then they just start to lose confidence. But that's how I'd go about it, is I'd go back to just the basic foundation, make sure that Jake has the idea to get into that trailer. It's not you, the pattern of him, you know, following you in because you're leading him. Make sure there's no hole there, that he is just jumping in there happy, willingly, not backing out until you ask him to. And then start changing some patterns. If he's still nervous about when the vehicle starts, just do a bunch of that. Do a bunch of that until he starts disassociating negative experiences to when that engine starts. I mean, you haven't even put it in gear. Why would he panic when the engine starts? So those are associations that horses begin to make because of past experiences. So if you take this point in time right now, you can't help what's happened to this point. All you can do is overlay new experiences, new positive experiences with old ones. And also, when you're asking a horse to get into a trailer, you know, you talk about feeding them in the trailer and brushing them in the trailer and those kinds of things. That isn't necessarily a challenging thing, you know, for a horse to endure. It's when that trailer goes into motion. Please do not put yourself in the back of a trailer thinking that that would bring the horse more confidence. I've heard of people doing that, saying, oh, I'm going to ride back in there with them. Please do not do that. Don't put your precious self in that situation. But the other thing, the other comment you made about people have said, well, there's horses that just can't be trailered. Maybe there are, but I haven't found one. But it's by going back to the foundation every time. So I hope that that helps give you some ideas. One of the things I recommend on my video is take your horse for rides in the trailer. You know, go, you know, load your horse in the trailer and go pick up the kids, go grocery shopping, stop at the bank, run your errands. Kids love it. Mom came, brought Jake in the trailer, that kind of a thing. And it doesn't hurt the horse because it becomes a more positive pattern. The horse isn't being taken somewhere strange or taken to a vet or, you know, any of those things. The horse is just going for a ride, you know, just like you'd load the family dog in the car. And that can give you and the horse more confidence in just, you know, what should be a normal task is just to load a horse in a trailer and go somewhere. So, okay. I hope that helps that situation.
Yeah, that's great. And that last tidbit about just loading and going somewhere, then they would be less likely to be in a hurry, because sometimes I think that happens too. We get in a, got to go somewhere quick, and so then it's hurry and load.
Well, you know, there's lots of pieces. There's lots of elements. It's, you know, we get a horse in a trailer, the back feet get in, and, man, we shut the door right then. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't mean, just because all four feet are in the trailer, doesn't mean that horse is right about being in the trailer. So those are all really important things to know.
Okay. Well, great. Well, we will move on. And this next email, Karen, I'll have to say I got excited about because I read through it, and I'm thinking, oh, good. Because it was going out to Arizona. It's a long haul in a trailer, and it's from Lori, and it says, my horses are used to traveling for short periods in a trailer, 1 to 3 hours maximum. How would you prepare your horse to travel large distances like Indiana to Arizona? And I'm thinking, oh, good, Bumblebee Camp. She's going there, and I need somebody to go out there with me. So I call her. Yeah,
You might want to get a hold of Lori.
Yeah, well, you're just thinking 2011. I'm thinking, oh, no, 2010.
Oh, yeah.
We need to be a little more spontaneous here.
Well, you know what's really amazing about horses? I mean, you could take time and have, you know, take your horse on gradually longer trips and, you know, get your horse used to more time in the trailer. But, you know, if your trailer hauls well, you know, which means it's solid, and that kind of goes back to the last suggestion of ride in the back of your trailer. You know, there was an experience I had with a trailer that I had. I didn't realize a weld had broke until I rode in the back of it. Somebody I trusted implicitly was driving, and you couldn't see that the weld had broke until there was a certain amount of speed and a vibration would hit in the trailer, and I could see where one of the welds broke right up by where my horse's noses were. But it was the thing to do is go into a trailer and just start pushing on things, push on welds, you know, push on your dividers, you know, rattle your dividers and see, you know, if they're solid, if everything's falling solid. But, you know, if everything is solid in your trailer and your trailer hauls well, it's really amazing how quickly horses adapt to long hauls. You know, in the beginning when I would haul horses, I'd taken college courses, and, you know, the instructions were very conservative. Get your horse out every, you know, 3 or 4 hours, walk them for 20 to 30 minutes, you know, all of these kinds of things. And it was really interesting to me. I went on the road with a clinician years ago, and it was for an internship. And I'll tell you what, we hauled down the road, and that was the first time I was kind of exposed to, well, gosh, aren't we supposed to stop? Aren't we supposed to do this? Aren't we supposed to do that? And it was interesting that the feedback I got, and I have really thought about it, and I've hauled horses, you know, long hauls for years and years and years now. The horses have motion when they're in the trailer. They're shifting their weight. They have motion. I don't find that horses stock up or get stiff like a horse that would have to stand in a stall for that period of time might be. A horse that has to just stand still on still earth actually has less movement and motion than a horse that's being hauled in a trailer. They have a shift of weight, and they're kind of in motion with the motion of the rig. The other thing is, you know, horses having to drink. You know, obviously you can't leave free choice water in there. I've not had horses that won't drink on the road. If I want them to drink more, say it's kind of a warm day, I want them to drink more, I use just regular molasses, just that you can get in the grocery store. And you might even get your horse ahead of time drinking molasses water, and it becomes like a treat for them. And they'll drink more water because the sweetness of it appeals to them. So it's like a, you know, kids drink more soda than water because of the taste of it. But you can put that in there. It actually helps absorption in their body, prevents them from becoming dehydrated. And it really is a way to get a horse to drink more. But I've personally not had a problem with any horse that I've hauled long distances in adapting to the amount of time in the trailer or eating or drinking. Now, if you do have a long haul, I do like to feed my horses along the way. But, I mean, I'm hauling, you know, 12 hours, 16 hours, you know, long, long hauls like that. And but I do like to have free choice feed for my horses when I'm hauling. Obviously, if you're feeding something that's high protein alfalfa or a high concentrate feed, you can't offer them free choice. But just like a low grass hay, of course, get them used to it before you go. And so I do feed my horses in the trailer on long hauls. On short hauls, I don't feed my horses in the trailer. They don't necessarily need it, and I don't ever want food to be a bribe for my horse getting into the trailer. So, you know, you make that decision. But it's really amazing. When I bought Debutante, I guess it's been a couple years ago now, he literally came off the field, went into the trailer, and we were on the road. And it was really interesting because every time we stopped somewhere, it was like he'd get out of the trailer and go, "Oh, is this where we live?" And for about the first few stops, he'd go, oh, this is where we live. And the second stop was at Lexington Mounted Police. And I was thinking in his mind, he's thinking, "Oh, I guess I'm a police horse now." And, you know, after a few weeks on the road, and of course, Brigante, the old seasoned holler, he's like, "You'll get it here in a while, kid. We live on the road." And horses really adapt and become very confident. My horses just think it's just another day when they're out there and they're on the road and they're hauling down the road. And the adaptability for those horses has really been next to nothing. It's really amazing. Horses are so adaptable. Every horse I've hauled for long distances have honestly really just been fine. So, but you can do that. You can start off and put your horse in a trailer and go for a 3-4 hour drive, make it a 6 hour drive, make it an 8 hour drive. You can do that. Go on the internet and find overnight facilities and travel all day one day, stay overnight at a nice facility, a bed and breakfast. There's some really neat places on the internet, very nice people you'll meet on the road, and then ride for the next day and then load up and head back home and have your horse get used to it that way. But, I think you'll be amazed when you take your horse on the road with you. They just go along just loading up the kids or the family dog, and off we go.
Okay. So that means, Lori, you're going to be getting a phone call, and anybody else that wants to go out to Arizona that is passing through Indiana, get in touch with me. So do you want to give the dates real quick while we're talking about the Bumblebee Camp? It's coming up soon.
Okay, it's February 7th is the beginning of the first week, and then February 13th is the beginning of the second week, the Advancing Week.
Okay. So, and certainly you can look on the website for more information on the camps. And like I say, if you're coming through Indiana, you can get a hold of me that way as well. So, anyway, we'll move on to a question from Beth, and. She says, "Karen, I was fortunate to attend one of your clinics in Montana. It was about a year and a half ago. I do have a problem that you might be able to help with your vast experience, you might be able to help solve. This past spring, I bought a 7-year-old quarter horse mare for my 10-year-old daughter. We were thrilled with this mare, and she was just what my daughter needed. She was calm enough that my daughter could ride her around the pasture alone without me worrying. The mayor loved to jump also, and the two of them attended a few local hunter jump shows this summer and did very well. Shortly after we bought the mare, I noticed that she fussed a lot with the snaffle bit we had. We had got her teeth loaded and tried a few different bits until we found a roller bit that she seemed to like. Also, from the beginning, she carried her head a bit crooked at a canter, kind of twisted to the right with her chin up. Floating her teeth and changing the bit did not fix this. After a wonderful summer and fall, about 6 weeks ago, the mare's personality began to change. Instead of nickering when we came to her stall, she would pin her ears. Instead of standing forever to be brushed and fussed over, she would pin her ears. And when asked to canter on either lead, she would pin her ears, and I figured it was a mare heat issue and would improve shortly, but instead it has gotten worse. She now humps and tries to buck when we ask her to canter or trot or move forward at all, and has the nastiest expressions on her face. We've received lots of well-intended advice from all sorts of people at the barn where we board, and start her on regimen, get her hocks injected, give her arthritis medicine, ride her hard, whip her literally and back into shape. I did have a trainer who is more skilled and braver than I ride her, but very stern riding and a lot of sweating did not seem to help. My sympathetic side said that she must be in pain. Why else would she change so much? It seemed to make more sense than just a personality behavior issue. I tried three different saddles in case mine was pinching somewhere, but that didn't seem to make a difference. So this past weekend, I took her to the vet chiropractor who said that her back was messed up probably due to slipping on ice or snow when it turned out. He worked on her for quite a while and said she would be fine after 24 hours. I had very high hopes that this was the miracle cure, but she is just the same this next week. I am just heartsick that this mare was what my daughter's best friend had changed to this point that my daughter doesn't even want to ride her anymore. I beg this mare to tell me what's bothering her so I can fix it, but she just pins her ears at me. I'm just not sure what to try next. Do you have any light bulbs going off in your head? Any direction you can point me? Maybe it's something as simple as watch my DVD number 4 and do X and Y. Why are certainly willing to work hard to get this poor mare back to where she was last summer. Thanks so much, Beth. That one's puzzling, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it can be so many things. For having such a, and I'm guessing at the period of time, since you got the mare to when this started happening, my guess is at least 6 months, something a year, might be even a little bit longer. If the mare had, such a pleasant disposition, I would say that that's her nature to have that. It's not something that started, a few weeks after you got her or something like that. And it sounds like you've taken all of the routes to rule out, physical problems. The only thing I question in hearing all those things is going back to the teeth. Floating the teeth, in my opinion, is not the thorough equine dental practitioner's approach to balancing the teeth. And the reason I say that is because I've had my horse's teeth floated. I understand what floating the teeth are, basically knocking the points off. As horses' teeth grow throughout their lifetime, and they depend on the surface of each tooth evenly. And what happens is if you get a slight imbalance, that continual grinding from their, chewing of their food causes little irregularities to become big irregularities. So somebody can float a horse's teeth but not actually balance the horse's jaw, from side to side or forward to back. So it's kind of a rounding motion of that lower jaw. What I would suggest is to go online and get some information from an equine dental practitioner in your area. Find people who will give them recommendations, or find a veterinarian that has gone to equine dental school, and that's a 2-year school. There's a couple of them around, but the study of equine dentistry is much more extensive than has been done traditionally in the past, and I've seen and experienced the dramatic effects that if a horse's jaw is locked up, you'll see it behaviorally. You'll see changes in their back. Their back actually will go out if their jaw and their you know, the plates are not in alignment, it has all kinds of physiological effects of doing that. Now, if the horse is pinning your ears in a stall, sometimes I can wonder if a horse doesn't have enough to do, if she's not getting out enough, or if she's, you know, a little too cooped up. Sometimes what can happen is a horse can pin its ears in a stall and somebody can go by and say, hey, knock it off and get after her. A lot of times horses, they become more aggressive with that kind of a behavior. So, you know, you can even question if anybody else is handling your horse or anybody else is around your horse. I've noticed a dramatic difference in my horses. It hasn't happened very often, but one time I walked into my horse's stall and he had such a different behavior that I questioned the people that were cleaning the stalls. And it turned out that the person was used to having horses, you know, he had to shove them over to get them out of the way. Well, my horses were so light that he gave my horses big shoves, and I'll tell you what, they were going to jump out the window. And so you have to consider every kind of factor that can be contributing to it, because it certainly sounds like a physiological change that's happened in the horse. The other thing then is, in ruling all of that out, is to explore the physical side of it. Because sometimes what happens is when the horse pins its ears or gets nippy or something like that, we can, not even realizing it, we can inadvertently reinforce the behavior by backing off and going, oh, what's wrong, darling? And the horse goes, nothing's wrong. I pinned my ears and we stopped, and we don't even realize that we have reinforced a behavior like that. So sometimes when horses are pinning their ears or acting kind of witchy towards me, I go, man, you don't have time to pin your ears. If I've ruled out all the physical side, if behaviorally I'll look at it and say, you don't have time to pin your ears. You need to hurry up and go. And it's really amazing, because all of a sudden the horse says, man, I don't have time to pin my ears. We got to move. But that's because I have the confidence in my feel, my timing, my release. And honestly, when you're looking at a situation like this, you're going to try lots of different things. You're going to come at it behaviorally, come at it, you know, through the physiology. You're going to come at it in lots of different ways, just searching for that little piece that'll help that turn around. So behaviorally, if you want to look at it that way, when a horse starts pinning its ears, rather than backing off and saying, oh, you must be hurting, I go, boy, you know, hurry up and let's go. One of the things that I see, we've done this, you know, I've done this myself, and I see lots of other people do this, is the horse is a little bit off. I've actually experienced horses that you could turn them out in the pasture and they'll just tear it up. But when you bring them in and ask them to do something, you know, circle or do something, they get a little bit of a limp. And I've seen horses actually limp because people will stop and say, oh, darling, what do you do? Is something wrong? But you could turn that horse loose, and he'd tear around like a, you know, having a ball. So it's really interesting. Behavior is so subtle with horses. You really have to kind of explore that option as well, and just, you know, do a little bit of self-reflection and say, gosh, when the horse pinned her ears, did I back off? You know, when the horse kind of humped up and bucked a little bit, did I, you know, slow the horse down and say, oh, gosh, something must be hurting you. See, and that's the challenging thing in this kind of a question, this kind of a scenario, because you've tried three different saddles, you're getting the same behavior. You know, it could be the way your cues are being delivered. I'm not mentioning that so much here because it sounded like, you know, your cues wouldn't have changed from the first period of time when everything was, you know, nice and she was calm and willing to now, unless it has changed. Maybe you have come in and learned some different things and taking a little bit different approach. So my answer is, if you want to examine it behaviorally, yes, go through the DVDs, and it'll operate like a diagnostics tool, and you can sort through things, and you can see on the DVDs my presentation, you know, how I would approach this horse from a lead horse's point of view. You know, you'll see a wonderful example there, because if a mayor doesn't view you in the leadership position, you will get pinned ears and kind of witchy behavior. Mayors are much less tolerant. We've talked about this in other teleseminars. Geldings are the most tolerant of our learning stages of communication with horses. Mayors are less tolerant of that. If you're not good, they'll let you know. And stallions have zero tolerance, you know, especially under certain conditions and different stallions to different extents. But you may be dealing with it behaviorally. It certainly sounds like you've ruled out the physical side. But that's what I would do, is I'd go back and just, you know, keep going back to the foundation and see if you can't find out. That's why it's like being a detective. You know, they can't tell you. They're telling you something, but you don't know which approach to go in, physical, you know, mental, emotional, behavioral, and you just have to try all of them until you finally find out what clicks again.
Okay. Well, great. So are you ready to move on then, Karen?
Sure.
Okay. We've got a question here that really, there was two people that had very similar situations going on, so I've kind of combined the two of them. One of them is from Gail, and one's from Stephanie. I think we'll read one, and then we'll let you answer that, and then we'll kind of read the other one and see if you think there's anything in addition you might want to add to that. But this is on one of probably the biggest topics that you hear of, and that's regaining your confidence after a scary accident. And this one says, I've recently discovered your audio conference calls, and I've gone back and listened to a couple of them. I've also heard there's some effort going on to set up a 2010 clinic in Sisters, Oregon. I hope you are able to make it, as I would love to attend one of your clinics. I have a 6-year-old paint mare that is typically quiet, well-mannered, and somewhat lazy, and she has been a very good confidence builder for me, as my most previous high-strung thoroughbred was simply too much for a recreational person to handle and even kept me away from horses for about 8 years. In September of 08, it's funny how we remember those dates, isn't it? My husband and I took our two horses to Central Oregon for some trail riding. It was one of those trips where nothing was going right, including the weather. It was windy and somewhat stormy when we arrived, so we put the horses up for the day and waited to ride the following day. The weather wasn't cooperating again, but we headed out to the barn during a break in the weather. Everyone was very calm and cooperative during the saddling process. When it then hit the arena for a warm-up prior to heading out on the trail. My husband only rides 3 or 4 times a year, so as we were getting ready, I was paying more attention to him and his horse than my mare and myself. He successfully mounted and began walking around the arena. My mare would not hold still to be mounted, but I hopped on anyway. Then led to immediate bucking. Then she reared up full height. I slid off as she came down, and we went up again. She fell over backwards. I got my husband off his horse, as he is my first priority. Then I shouted for my mare to whoa, which she immediately did, and I immediately took her back into the round pen, where she cantered in circles for at least 5 minutes, reversing at my command. Then I did get back up on her in the round pen, which went well. Then we rode her into the arena for about 15 minutes. By then, the weather was changing again, and I was an emotional wreck, so we put them back up for the day. This is the first and only time my mare had ever reared up when mounted. She's one of the horses that loves to rear up and paw at the air when at play. Here's my issue. Now, every time we go somewhere new to ride, I get very nervous. I still go, but the first few minutes are nerve-wracking. My mare stands perfectly still to mount at home, but she walks off when I mount her elsewhere. I turn her in circles until she stops, but my confidence is not where it should be. I get nervous, and I'm sure she knows it. In fact, I'm reluctant to school her on the trail if she tries to turn around because I'm worried about the results. What can I do to calm myself and trust my mare? And I know I made a bad judgment call in 2008, but I need to somehow get past it. Any ideas would be greatly appreciated.
Well, the thing that's the challenge with horses is, you know, I wish I could say that there was one quick little answer that will, you know, resolve all of that. But really what happens is that we go along under certain conditions and everything's fine with the current skill set that we have. What happens is with horses is that conditions inevitably change. The horse changes, their attitude changes, the situation changes, the conditions change. And then that's when we find where our skill set is not. And that's really what happened is you got into a situation and you realize in hindsight, you know, it's 2020, you realize in hindsight that you should not have got on that day. And, you know, really honestly with horses, and as in anything, we get good judgment by surviving our bad judgment. The next time you're in that situation and your horse is behaving that certain way, you'll recognize it and go, you know what, I'm not getting on that horse. See, sometimes that's the best decision to make. I don't care what your expectation is or what other people's expectations are of you. You know, recognizing a behavior and deciding not to get on is honestly sometimes the best thing that you can do. Or if you get into a situation, to know how to get off safely. And that's one of the things that I take people through is, you know, people ask me all the time, well, you know, why do you teach people how to do things on the ground? You know, we're not training the horse until we're riding the horse. And it's twofold. You know, the first thing to understand is that I want to know what that horse is, not their physical ability is that day so much as their mental and emotional. Their physical will match that, what their mental and emotional state is. And have I established the communication with that horse on the ground first before I ever put my precious self up on the horse's back? The other thing is that when we're on the ground, we're actually teaching our hands to act independently of what the rest of our body is doing. And people don't always understand that. When you're on the ground, your communication with your horse, your feel of your horse, is isolated to just what your hands are doing. So you can train your hands to have the muscle memory and do the right thing, not when everything's, you know, rainbows and butterflies, but when things go wrong. When a horse rears up, they will oftentimes rear up because our legs are squeezing and our hands are pulling. When I ask in high-level dressage, it's called a levade. And people pay big bucks for that. A horse can do levade. People actually want that. It's a warfare maneuver. So, you know, when I teach my horse Bergante, he's at a stage I've taught him. And remember, I've not taught him anything. He goes out and plays with his buddies, and he levades all over the place. So it's not that I taught him to do that, but I created communication to him when I ask him to do that. So when I do that, I'm holding him with my legs and lifting with my reins. But when that happens, when we're not planning on it, that's actually what we've done in a survival reaction that has actually contributed to that behavior. So one of the things to understand is when you're riding, your emergency brake and diffusion, the way to diffuse any of those maneuvers is to take the hindquarters away, to disempower the hindquarters by disengaging the hindquarters. And that's why when people move from on the ground, I teach people how to disengage the hindquarters first on the ground. Then when you get up onto the horse's back, you practice disengaging the hindquarters. When a horse's hindquarters are disengaging, it means their, I'm going to call it their inside leg. Say if you're using your right rein, you're tipping the nose to the right, you're pushing with your right leg to push the hip over to the left. So the right hind leg is stepping up under the horse's body as it's turning. But it's not turning in a circle. It's actually kind of turning in place right there. But a horse that's disengaging the hindquarters actually is, the hindquarters is disempowered. It can't actually physically rear in the air. You've taken the power away. Any athletic maneuver a horse does, whether it's running, rearing, kicking, you know, anything, it requires the power in the hindquarters. That's where the engine of the horse is. So when you take that power away, a horse, you know, it's very difficult for a horse to rear or to bolt or to kick, you know, another horse. It's really the answer to so many behaviors, and that's where you demonstrate leadership from up on the horse's back. So what I would do to rebuild your confidence is to get more knowledge. And, you know, lacking confidence means you have fear. You know, those kind of go hand in hand there. And I just wrote an article about this. I'm going to Canada this weekend for a horse owners conference, and they asked me to put, you know, into writing the notes from what I'm going to talk about. And that's exactly what I'm talking about, is that our skill set, all of us, all of our skill sets, I don't care how long you've been in horses or how educated you are, there's a limitation to our skill set, our current skill set. That's why I'm committed to continued learning myself. So you got into this situation and your skill set didn't match the need in that situation. So in order to go back and rebuild your confidence, it's going back and developing your skills first on the ground for you and your horse, and then up on the horse's back, practicing in a safe environment. It sounds like everything goes really well at home. And then take your horse to an environment that's strange, but say, you know, there's not 50 other horses waiting to go on a ride. You're not under any kind of pressure. Start taking that base of communication out to different locations. So you reinforce your communication in different environments and go out on a windy day and go out, you know, under different conditions so that you do have the opportunity to reestablish your communication in every situation. And that's really what leadership is really all about. That's the foundation of my program, is how to establish leadership. And being a great leader means being a great communicator under all conditions. And so there's so many pieces. You'll go back to just getting that communication in a rope halter and bending that horse, having that horse laterally flexed. And so when you get under duress, what happens is, number one, you would have better judgment not to get on the horse. And number two, if you did get on the horse and the horse became resistant, or, you know, the horse is going along and you want to go one direction and your horse wants to go another and you start getting problems, you know how to bend that horse and safely get off the horse. Reassert your leadership on the ground until the horse's mind changes. The respect level comes up again, and you can step back on and confidently go off, you know, in the direction you're choosing, not just going along with the horse all the time. And unfortunately, that's what we tend to do. We tend to, lots of people do this, if that makes you feel any better, is that we go along and we say, well, you know, the horse wants to go this way and I don't want to fight, and, you know, off we go. This way looks good too. You know, the horse says, well, it's time to go back home. And you go, it was getting kind of late. We should go back home. We don't always realize that we're deferring leadership to the horse when we do those things. So your question is then, how do I get that back? And that's what I would recommend, is just going back to the foundation, getting your communication established, reestablished on the ground, with more understanding, better timing, better feel, better release. You know, take it up onto the horse's back, and so you have something to draw from when you get into those situations.
Okay. And Karen, I'm going to go ahead and add a couple pieces here on Anne's question. It, like I said, it does kind of relate to the same, but there may be some other pieces you might want to add to it. Her and her husband are 46, and they just got their first horse. She did see you at a seminar at the Equine Fair show in Springfield last November, so she has seen some of your things. They were riding together, and she ended up basically getting bucked off, and her questions kind of come back to, is there anything you'd recommend, specific exercises or tips to improve on her riding when she's trying to ride together with a group of horses and help her manage her fear so that her emotions don't come out there? So I didn't know if there's any additional pieces in with that group riding that's become an issue for her.
Yeah. Well, it really is the same answer, and that's why when people are educators, a lot of times the answers to the questions keep sounding exactly the same. It's get more knowledge, more depth of knowledge of what it is that you're ever going to ask a horse to do. You know, the difference between steady pressure versus rhythmic pressure, and then desensitizing a horse to motion. You know, horses aren't like getting a quad or a bicycle or something like that out. And in fact, I've had people say, well, my husband's only going to ride this horse. That was another kind of a flag that came up. My husband's only going to ride this horse two times a year. And honestly, I mean, if just to be completely blunt and honest, get a quad, you know, right? Because a horse is not like, you know, any other vehicle, you know, where you can go out and, you know, even a motorcycle, if you're not that skilled, the motorcycle is still going to do what you know. You know, the motorcycle is going to reflect your skill and ability. A horse has a mind and a heart and has its own ideas. And so the operating instructions, you know, and this has been my history, if you look in my background on my website, you know, I got my first horse and somebody helped me put a saddle on her and off we went down the road. You know, with very little instruction. And, you know, knowing what I know now, that's why I can honestly say that God, I'm living proof that God takes care of fools and children. But I was too old to be one of them. Because we just don't get the operating instructions, the psychology, the understanding, the communication. And so it really goes back to getting more of that so that in any situation you will do, you have a better chance of doing the right thing if you have more knowledge and more skills. You're obviously more prepared for the situations as they arise, because they will arise. They will. So it's an important thing with horses. I can't emphasize it enough.
Okay.
And here's my question, just kind of in summary of that. Why would we ever hesitate to buy a video or go get to a clinic or even go online and just, you know, search and search and search? I have lots of free videos on my website. Why would we ever not do that when the risk of being unknowledgeable with horses is so great? And I guess that's a personal thing I've learned, you know, I've got good judgment by surviving my bad judgment, and I just can't get enough knowledge. I'm searching for it all the time. I've ridden with two different educators myself, you know, this summer. So it's really important to budget for the educational part of the horses as much or more so than anything else. I'd rather have a new video than a new, you know, blanket. Let the horse wear a torn blanket with duct tape. That nothing's going to get hurt from that. But if you don't have a piece of knowledge that you're going to need when you get into that situation, it can have devastating results. And recovering from, you know, those situations, recovering your confidence, it can be a long, long journey to do it. It can be done, but the only way I know how to do it is to gain more knowledge. So get the knowledge in advance. Don't wait for something to happen and put you in that kind of a hole.
Okay, that's great. Karen, this next question, it was funny when I read this one. I thought of your TV programs, and then I thought of my 3-year-old granddaughter watching your program on saddling for so long, and I thought, gosh, this is something she could have been asking because she watched that one forever. This one's from actually Deborah, and it says, "Dear Karen, I was watching your show on Dish and saddling your horse. I enjoyed it very much. I also met you at the Equine Affair in Massachusetts, and I purchased 3 of your DVDs. You and I discussed the missing pieces of my puzzle. I wondered why you don't secure the stirrup over the saddle horn before hoisting the saddle onto the horse's back. I always do, since I don't want to hit my horse on his side with the stirrup. Kind regards, Deborah." So I guess she's wanting you to discuss that a little bit.
Sure. And that's a common thing that we're taught to do, is to put, you know, usually we're saddling from the on side, which means the left side of the horse. So we'll pick up the right stirrup and put it up over the saddle horn or over the seat of the saddle as we're putting the saddle on. The problem lies in, and nothing bad ever, you know, really seems to happen. Most of the time we have gentle horses and things like that. But when you put a saddle up like that, number one, it's imbalanced, and number two, when you set it up there, that stirrup has a possibility of swinging down and bumping your horse on the other side. So when you do it that way, you are going to bump your horse in the side unexpectedly. When I swing it up, and the way I show people on that the television show and in my instructional DVDs is that I saddle from the offside. I'll come up, I have the saddle balanced on my hip. The way I hold my saddle, I can hold it with one hand. All my latigos, I show everybody how to tie up your latigos, how to tie up your cinches so they're not falling down and dragging in the dirt. And when I swing everything up and over, it swings up in such a way that it doesn't flop down and hit suddenly on the back of my horse. And I started learning this technique years ago when I was starting colts, because I thought, oh my gosh, we're going to start a colt, never been saddled. You know, you want that stirrup to be up and not flopping down. Well, horses actually get used to things very, very easily, and I know where the stirrup's going to be when I swing that saddle on. If I pick that stirrup up and place it on the back of the horse, that I don't know if or how that stirrup's going to, you know, come down and bump that horse in the elbow on the other side. And if they get bumped on that other side, they're going to jump into you. So even though, you know, our gentle saddle horses, they kind of get used to all that stuff, and I'm like, okay, whatever. I've just found that it's just not really necessary. The way I tied up my latigos, and you saw that on the television show, and tie up your cinches, all those things, nothing's dragging on the ground. You can swing up there. One of the reasons I saddle on the offside is because I'm already there to drop my cinches down. So my cinches are tied up. I swing my saddle up over the horse's back. And rather than being on the on side of my horse, on the horse's left side, put the saddle on, then I got to scurry around to the other side, drop my cinches, and then scurry back to cinch again. I'm already on that right side, so I drop my cinches and I save myself a trip around the horse. Plus, it's good. It's just good habits. It's good habits to be able to saddle your horse from either side. But that's really the reason why I don't put the stirrup up over the back of the saddle. It just swing that up on there and just one even flow like you saw on the television show. It just works really nice. It's more comfortable for the horse the way it swings down. It doesn't bang into the side of them like it does if you put the stirrup up over the on the horn or over the seat of the saddle.
So, okay. Deborah, thanks for tuning in to Karen's TV show. Karen, you want to remind people when to tune in for that, for those that may not know when your TV
well,
show is on?
Well, it's on Dish Network. It's on channel 9411. It's an educational channel. And I don't have the days and times off the top of my head because they air it four different times throughout the week. So it's the same show aired four times throughout the week, and then next week's a different show. The show that started this week that's airing this week is the first in a three-part series with Dan Moyer. It's an introduction to ranch roping. And I'm really proud of that series. And even if you think you'll never ranch rope, you know, in your whole life, it's really interesting to see the stages and, you know, maybe it'll open up some possibilities for you, maybe not if ranch roping, but maybe other activities, and see how you can take your horse through different stages to do new things with your horse.
Mm-hmm. I did see that one, Karen. That is a good one. If you've not seen that and you get an opportunity to record it and see that, it's definitely worth the time to sit down and watch that. So
yeah, Dan Moyer does clinics, does ranch roping clinics, and he's one of those people that is very, very knowledgeable, and you'll never hear about him. I come across people like that every so often, and when I get a chance to do something like the television show with somebody like Dan, I like to do that because, you know, he just has so much knowledge, but he's such a quiet person. He just wouldn't, you know, put himself out there, you know, but I don't mind doing that for him because I just think he's just so knowledgeable and a very, very good teacher as well.
Okay. Okay, well, we've got time, I think, for one more question here, Karen. And
Right. This
one kind of ties back into the regaining confidence, but she's kind of got a different twist to it. And so she's kind of got it titled under relaxing the nervous horse, but we'll see where you go with this one. It says, my problem is my horse's lack of confidence in me. 95% of the time he listens, complies, cooperates. He is an 18-year-old standardbred and my first ever horse. I've had him for 3 years and I'm 58 years old. He was a harness racer in his early career, probably with blinders. He constantly checks his perimeters, even when eating carrots in his own yard. Once we went with friends out at the Hanson Dam, past several full soccer fields of kids playing, balls flying, whistles, crowds, etc., I felt like we would explode. I got off, calmed down, and walked him once well past the noise, mounted, and continued a wonderful ride. I felt like I cheated myself and him by complying to his fear instead of staying on and eventually riding away with him. Last Sunday, after a year of controlled, successful riding, going down an all too familiar trail, he spooked at something in the bushes, spun around. I flew off and proceeded toward home. This time, luckily, it was a soft landing and no foot was stuck in the stirrup, one of my biggest fears. Now I'm resolved to work on this aspect of our relationship here in 2010. So she's
okay.
Kind of wanting to know how to overcome the horse's fears.
Yeah. Well, the thing to understand is that, you know, horses being prey animals, until the day they die, they know that they're on the food chain. So they're always, you know, have their radar on and looking for things. And it can be something like, you know, the bird flutters or, you know, the silliest little things. And we have the same thing. We turn the corner and, you know, somebody's in the room or the cat jumps or something and, you know, we jump. So it's a natural thing for us to jump. The thing with horses is they go, they don't just jump. They can jump and go into high speed, you know, tear out of there if they deem it, you know, if they, you know, feel that's necessary for survival. So the thing to go back to again is the great communication comes from great leadership. And I would go back again to those situations. One of the things I'll talk about is in that beginning when you were saying that, Melinda, and said, you know, it was a soccer field and the crowds and the horse got upset and I got off, I was sitting here listening to this and I gave you a thumbs up. Mm-hmm. I gave you a thumbs up. I was like, good, get off. There's nothing wrong with that. I don't know why that has become so entrenched in our minds, you know, in the industry, is, you know, get off. What your brain is doing is it's saying, get down into a safer position closer to the ground. So if this horse moves, because horses can move, you know, laterally, up, down, backwards, in an instant, at high speed, and until you condition yourself and teach yourself to respond appropriately in that same instant, then you should get off into a safer position, wait until conditions change, which sounds like you did. You walked along, further away you got, horse calmed down, you calmed down, you got back on and went along. So you didn't cheat yourself. If anything, you cheated death, you know, maybe. Because, but the question you're asking then is, how do you go back and teach yourself how to have the immediacy of the response when the horse behaves in a certain way. And I'll give you an example of that. We're finishing up editing some videos, some educational videos, and it's horses that have problems, needle shy, and things like that. And I'm watching myself on video, and the horse starts swinging his head, and I can see it frame by frame. And it's really amazing because when I watch it regular speed, I look like Ninja Woman. I mean, I look like I have this immediacy. My arm comes up and blocks the head from, you know, knocking me over. And, I mean, this horse was really swinging its head back and forth. But in frame by frame, that horse's head is coming towards me, and my arm, in my eyes, looking at it frame by frame, I am so slow to respond to that. That horse has crossed the center line and is in, you know, like two or three frames towards me before my arm comes up and blocks him from actually, you know, really clocking me in the head. So when you break things down into those kind of nanoseconds, you know, everybody talks about living in the moment. There's four moments in a second. Horses live in the moment. And, you know, even though I'm conditioned to match that as closely as possible, it's really amazing to me to see that and observe that and go, wow, it seems late in that kind of a time. But in real time, it looks like there's an immediacy of response for me. And that's what we need to do. We need to develop habits under good conditions, under non-threatening conditions, you know, like I keep reiterating, so that when the conditions change, when you come across, you know, a field full of kids and soccer balls and crowds and everything, and your horse starts moving. You know, like the other day I said I had to go through a tunnel underneath a highway, and, you know, there's big piles of tumbleweeds, you know, crawl. I mean, it looked like a haunted house going in there. My horse was looked at me and said, "You're kidding." And I said, "Let's go, boys. You know, I can see what it is." And they kind of went to turn and say, "Well, I don't think so." And I said, "You know what? I think so." And I kept giving them release when they went forwards, you know, and pressure when they didn't, and kept adjusting the turns. And pretty soon they just went, "Well, Karen says we're going through here, and here we go." So, but it's that feel and that timing. But there would have been a time that I might have got off and led my horse through there. And there's nothing wrong with doing that. You're not cheating it. But I wanted to see if I had the leadership up on the horse's back to say, "Hey, I know there's tumbleweeds. I see the tumbleweeds. I see this scary thing. I see that it's concrete. And I see, but all I see and my focus is on the light on the other side." And it was a long tunnel. And we went through there, and then the clippity-clop of their own, you know, hooves starts echoing through there, and I just go, they go, man, this looks scary to me, but Karen's not scared, here we go. But that didn't happen overnight. That didn't happen in the, you know, first even, you know, 7 years of owning horses. It really didn't happen. I don't, to tell you the truth, I don't know when it happened. It's just that I keep committing and recommitting myself to gaining more knowledge. And that knowledge goes back to the very basic foundation of what is steady pressure, what's rhythmic pressure, what is, you know, desensitizing a horse, all of those things, so that you have a foundation of communication to draw from. If you want to move to another country and operate in that other country, how fluent do you need to be to operate in that other country? If you're just visiting for a week, that's one level of fluency. If you're going to take a job there for a year, that's another level of fluency. If you're going to move there for your whole life and be a doctor, you know, that's a whole nother level of fluency, do you see? So you need to decide kind of how much skill level you need and then go back to the foundation of communication and just keep establishing that and reestablishing it and then just keep building your confidence as you challenge yourself in more and more situations. And all of a sudden one day you'll just go, wow, my horse spooked. I tipped the hindquarters away, picked up my horse, and then we moved on. Because when you're not trusting the horse is not trusting you, and it sounded like you said that already. And that's what we give our horse when we build our ability to develop good, great communication with them, is for them to be able to trust us in all conditions, in all situations. And that's what I think we have the obligation to give to our horses. They didn't put an ad in the paper for us. You know, we put the ad in the paper for them. We found them, brought them into our life. It wasn't their choice. So to me, it's our obligation to become the best partner we can be for them, which means being a great communicator with them.
Okay. Okay, well, that's great. So, well, looks like we probably need to start winding down, Karen. Is there anything else you want to add this evening before we close out this evening?
You know, I'm just so excited about this year. You know, we've had such great years every year, and I know everybody's had tough times in lots of different ways, and I just have such a desire to bring more education to people, and I just get so excited when I hear about people. They come back and say this helped them or that helped them, and, you know, that's really what I do this all for. So I'm looking forward to a year in 2010 to be able to help folks, you know, even more and advance their skills and help them with problems and all kinds of things. So I'm so glad to be able to do the teleseminars and have the opportunity to get out there and actually meet you and meet your horses and be able to help you a little bit, you know, have more fun with your horse.
Okay. Well, Karen, we certainly want to thank you for spending time with us this evening and sharing your knowledge with us. We want to thank all those that have tuned in tonight, and we ask that you keep your questions coming, and we'll want you to tune in on February the 10th, and that'll probably be hosted down while you're doing the Bumblebee Camp, so
get your
reservations in for that. Those are still coming in, and everybody have a safe and keep warm evening. So good night, everybody. Thanks, Karen, and we'll see you soon.
All right. Thanks, Melinda. Good night, everybody.
Good night. Bye-bye.